Celebrate America in style with fresh, delicious food from your neighborhood Vons. Shop with your club card and get amazing deals for a great 4th of July. Fire up the grill and cook up something special with USDA Choice Beef Ribeye Steak Bone-In Value Pack, just $5.39 a pound. And get a sweet deal on green seedless grapes, locally grown in Coachella Valley, only 99 cents a pound. Fresher meats, sweeter deals, better celebrations. Vons. Fact is, it's just better.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, I wish I could approach social rejection and bullying with scientific detachment. Unfortunately, I had too much experience as the butt of both when I was growing up. I sometimes joke that I wasn't just picked last for being picked last at dodgeball. I was also the stand-in for the ball. Now, we all know the saying that self-esteem comes from within, and I do think that's true. It's where it has to start. But my guest tonight, social neuroscientist Dr. Matthew D. Lieberman, finds in his research and that of others that it's actually socially based as well, that our self-esteem is actually socially based, and that isn't wrong or a bad thing. And that's only one of the fascinating findings about how surprisingly driven we are by our nature as social beings that he writes about in his new book, Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. Stick with us as Dr. Matthew Lieberman talks about many of these findings and how we can capitalize on them to improve our lives and our social and work relationships. Hello, Matthew.
Hey, Amy. How's it going?
Hey, great to have you here. I love your book. And now you write that in our evolutionary past, the better we understood the social environment, the better our lives became. And this actually hasn't changed.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the case. It's something that we may not sort of think about all that often or really recognize in our own lives, but it's absolutely essential, I think, to our well-being to understand the social world and navigate it in an intelligent way. And that was a really important thing, 50,000 years ago, and it remains true today.
And so you put up our need to belong right up there pretty much with the need for food and water as something that's very basic to us. And I think people would argue with that, but as I read your book, that seemed to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, there's this famous hierarchy of human needs. Abraham Maslow was a psychologist in the middle of last century, and he has this famous pyramid where he puts our sort of physical needs, like food and water, at the bottom, our social needs somewhere in the middle, and then self-actualization at the top, our ability to find meaning in life. And I think that as we look at the challenges that mammals face, and all humans are mammals, it turns out that our social needs are equal to food and water because we're born incapable of getting things like food and water for ourselves. The way little infants survive to become old enough to get those things for themselves is being wired such that they cry when they're separated from their caregiver. And caregivers, us as grown-ups, respond to that crying with a sense of wanting to go towards this noisy thing, our little children, to go provide them with the things that they need. So it's that social bond between parent and child that actually allows mammals to survive long enough to be able to take care of themselves. So that social bond is absolutely essential.
Yeah, and just the way you explained it, it's very persuasive that it actually is a survival need. And you illustrate our need to connect with each other with this very moving story at the beginning of your book, Social. It's a story about your grandparents. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, sure. My grandparents, came over from Europe around 1920 or so. Their parents came. They were born here. They lived the American dream. And then when they were in their 60s, my grandfather, who was one of my heroes growing up, my son is named after him, my grandfather passed away from cancer. And my grandmother was unhappy every day for the rest of her life after that. She never stopped the grieving process, and everything about her changed. Her personality changed, her memory degraded increasingly every year, and everyone in the family tried to understand why it was that she had changed so dramatically, and doctors tried to look into it. They thought it might be Alzheimer's, although there was never any evidence that it was. And what my grandmother used to say to me, I was a teenager at the time, every time she would see me, she would say, you know, I know what's causing all of this. I'm dying from the pain of a broken heart.
That's so sad. And you talk about, you know, well, maybe this is a design flaw in our neural architecture, because, I mean, for us to not be able to survive without that special person, but you came to feel differently about that through the process of your research.
Yeah, no, certainly that's the case. It's excruciatingly painful to go through the loss of a loved one, or to get rejected by someone who you hope would become a loved one. There's lots of ways in which we can be rejected, excluded, left out. And these are some of the most painful experiences we have. But if we weren't sensitive to these kinds of threats to our well-being, these kinds of threats in the same way that many other things are painful or threatening to us, we would be lost as individuals. We're not very good at living on our own. And this pain that we feel motivates us to find new social connections, to strengthen the ones we have, and to move forward in a socially connected way.
Now, this is not how we think of ourselves, these people who need people. We like to think of ourselves as these fiercely independent people in our behavior, in our thinking, but you illustrate so beautifully the reality of our quote-unquote independence with an experiment that used the Reagan-Mondale debate. Right, that people were worried Reagan was too old to be president. I'm going to read his quote so you don't have to remember it from memory. He joked in his debate with Mondale, "I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I'm not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and experience," and the audience just laughed their heads off. So talk about what happened and the research on this.
Right. So, I mean, the key thing to that joke being especially funny is that Mondale was actually, I think he was 56. He had already been vice president, but he was turning around the sort of age question about not being about him being elderly, but about his opponent being young. It was a very funny joke. It was obviously written ahead of time, as most of these kinds of things are. But the thing is that at the time, people thought that, you know, Reagan was losing his edge, and there was a real question about whether he was fit to still be president in a second term. And many commentators, and Walter Mondale himself, said these quips were the moment at which they knew the tide had turned and that Reagan was going to win again. So the question is, what was it about his performance that made the audience, and I remember seeing that live when I was a young child, the audience responded really strongly to that. What was that? What was driving that? And we tend to think, well, obviously, as an independent individual, I watched the debate and I made up my own mind. I evaluated what I saw and decided Reagan still had it. But Steve Fine, a social psychologist, did a very clever study shortly after that was done. And what he did is he had two groups of people who had not seen the debate see the debate in one of two ways. Some people saw the debate with the same way everyone else did, hearing the audience and so on. Other people heard the debate, but they didn't get to hear the laugh track. They didn't get to hear the audience in the stadium where the debate was held laughing. And it turns out that if you didn't get to hear the laughter, you didn't think Reagan won the debate. You thought Mondale had won the debate. And so the conclusion that this leads to, which is a very disturbing conclusion at first blush, is that what really led us to sort of see Reagan as the superior candidate in that moment was the laughter of, say, 200 people we have never met and never will meet, and that they actually affected the outcome of the election, that we were persuaded by their laughter rather than the quality of the performances from Reagan and Mondale. And that's a very different view of ourselves, as some might think of as overly conforming creatures or overly influenced creatures, than we typically think of ourselves.
And so you talk about harmonizing, you know, that, you know, people were so affected by the responses of the audience. You say that in Eastern cultures, it's generally accepted that only by being sensitive to what others are thinking and doing can we successfully do this, harmonize with other people so we can achieve more together than we can as individuals.
That's right. So, you know, these kinds of findings won't come as a surprise to people who are raised in Eastern cultures, because these are the part of the value system of Eastern culture, that we are interdependent, that we can do more together, and that we shouldn't always put our own goals first. We should think about what is it that the group needs to move forward, and I should try to facilitate what the group needs and harmonize with those group needs. In America and other Western cultures, we don't like to think of ourselves in these terms, but that doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that's not the story we tell about sort of what we're like.
And so pretty amazingly, in your own research, you found that the neural basis for our personal beliefs overlaps significantly with one of the regions of the brain that's primarily responsible for allowing other people's beliefs to influence our own. So why is that significant?
Well, in this work that we've done, there's lots of work where you can ask people to tell you what they know about themselves. So what kind of person are you? What are your preferences? What did you do for your sweet 16 birthday, if you had one of those? And so people reflect on their identity and their history as an individual. And these are the things that we think of that make us separate from other people. They make us our own personal sort of treasure chest of knowledge about us that nobody else has access to unless we choose to share it with them. So there's a particular region in the brain that sort of is associated with that kind of thinking. And in our work, we found that that same region of the brain is the region of the brain that's most predictive when it's active, that when someone tries to persuade you, when you see an advertisement that's trying to get you to do something, the more activity you see in that region, the more the person will change their beliefs and act in ways that are in line with the advertisement. And so what this suggests is that the region that we associate with being this sort of private treasure chest that isn't really connected to the social world is in fact very much connected. It's more of a social superhighway than a private cul-de-sac, the way we might tend to think of it. And so that was pretty surprising to us when we found it.
And I was very excited by your book, by all I learned, these things that we don't think about, ways that we are actually socially driven. And I am, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with Dr. Matthew D. Lieberman, social neuroscientist, and his book is Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. And now, I love this. You write that it turns out that our brains have a passion of their own. Mine seems to be not allowing me to work and do my writing, but no. What you write about is you say that our brains seem to devote nearly all of its spare time to one thing. So tell us what that one thing is.
Sure. That one thing seems to be thinking about other people, thinking about ourselves, and the relationship between those two things. Where do I fit in different social groups, in different dynamics with people? This is, again, consistent with what I was just saying, where our sense of who we are is far more socially constructed and socially maintained than we would have guessed. And there were these fascinating studies done over the last 15 years or so showing that the regions that support thinking about yourself and thinking about other people and thinking about the relationship between those two, whenever you give someone a boring task like doing math or keeping track of digits on a screen or letters or whatever it is, whenever you give them a break, these other regions just seem to pop on like a reflex. They pop on and they're associated with thinking socially. That's what comes on very reliably in almost every person. Almost every time you give them a break, you see these regions come on as the rest of the brain tends to quiet down.
Wow, it's so, so interesting. You did a study on this, on these math problems, and when you say when you stop doing them, you said actually only a few seconds of pause between the math problems. You know,
yeah.
That they just went right into what you call it our brain's default of social cognition, thinking about other people. So the math problem stops and you think about, you know, whether your math teacher likes you. And because this is so important to us that we you know, consider how to get along in the world.
Right. So, I mean, you know, it's funny. You opened this piece by saying that it seems like your brain's hobby seems to be getting distracted. And you know, if the thing you need to be doing is focusing on sort of some boring proofreading or something like that, then if you start thinking simply, that is a distraction from that task, but your brain doesn't care so much about that task. We're evolved to be sensitive to and mastering the social world. And so whenever our brain gets a chance, whenever there's a break in the action and your brain gets a chance to sort of idle for a bit, it tends to go back to this thing that it seems specialized for. The early studies tended to give people, say, 4 minutes of nothing to do. So you do math. Well, let's say you do math for a minute, and then you get a minute of nothing. And then you'd see this social network come on. And you can explain that pretty easily. You say, well, if you make someone lay in this boring PET scanner or MRI scanner, and you say, you're going to be laying here for a minute with nothing to do, it's not so surprising that they might start thinking about the party they were at last night or why their boss won't make eye contact with them lately. Uh-oh, does that mean I'm about to get canned or something like that? But in our study, what we found is that if you have someone do a math problem for 3 seconds and then only give them 2 seconds of rest before the next math problem, this system for thinking socially still pops up, even though you clearly have no interest in turning your attention away from the math for those 2 seconds. Your brain still says, I've got a break. I'm going to turn back to what my brain turns to by default, thinking socially.
And now what I like a lot about your book, Social, is that you will debate with yourself, you know, to show us that basically, okay, I got the caveats covered. And you'd say, isn't it obvious that people think about people when they're not otherwise engaged? Why is that so interesting? And you bring in Daniel Dennett, you know, who points out that it promotes understanding and empathy and cooperation and consideration. And so just talk a little bit about this.
Sure. So, Daniel Dennett's connection to this goes back to the very, very beginning. I suspect we'll sort of talk a bit more about this, but this idea of having what he called the intentional stance. When you see another person, what you see is a physical object, a very complex physical object, but that's what we all are, right? We're objects out in the world, and humans happen to be built so that when we look at other humans, we don't just see a body, we don't just see an object, we see something that is clearly possessed of a mind. And so we think, what is that person thinking? What is that person feeling? And that is a very, very special feature that we and maybe a few other animals have, although it's not clear to what extent any other animal has this. Approaching other people with that mindset of, geez, I wonder what they're thinking and feeling, is absolutely critical to us ever being able to get together as a group and have some kind of group-based goal, or to think about what the team leader wants next, or for a team leader to turn around and think, what do the people on my team need from me to feel like they'll be motivated to work hard, you know, next year in this coming year. And so it's really, I think, one of the most critical features that humans have that we don't really see in many other species.
Now, this is called theory of mind, and it really is, we really are mind readers. We just don't think about it that way, because what we're mind reading is that the guy across the street who's getting down on one knee, he's probably not asking the girl in front of him if he can borrow her pen. We know what's going on unless we're autistic. And so can you talk about how that shapes us, how that affects our lives, and then basically whether people can improve their ability to read other people?
Sure. So you pretty much couldn't do anything if you weren't a mind reader, and especially if you didn't have some sort of inborn readiness or tendency to engage in that kind of mind reading or to use that sort of theory of mind that we have. I would be utterly incapable of having this conversation with you because what I need to be doing right now is think about what you're understanding as I speak, and more importantly, thinking about what anyone else who's listening to this who may not have read the book, what will make sense to them, what might go over their heads, what might bore them because it's so obvious and pedestrian. You have to process all that, and we do that remarkably well. We don't get it right all the time, but if we didn't have that tendency, as you mentioned, that's very much like being, it's one of the sort of major symptoms of being autistic, is having real difficulty and a reduced tendency to engage in that kind of mind reading and making sense of the social world in those terms. So you can see by the difference between, autistic individuals and ourselves, what a change that makes in how we interact.
Yeah, and just the simple things, if you imagine these things you're talking about with the show, just sensing, okay, is the person across from me bored? You know, that's so important in functioning well socially. So is there a way that people who maybe aren't as good at sensing other people's intentions, that they can become better?
I think we don't know the answer to that at this very moment. I think that there is a lot of excitement very recently about the possibility that there could be training programs that could be sort of implemented to make that happen. There are simple things you can do, for individuals who have autism. Making an effort to actually look at the eyes of another person is going to give you a lot more information. And it turns out that if you look at the eyes, you're going to get the right information in that case, but there's a strong motivation not to make so much eye contact when you're autistic. What I want to sort of caution with any of these types of things is that there is a deep desire in any kind of self-help to sort of say, here are the sort of five steps to get better at, you know, your working memory, at your IQ, at your social ability. And I think that there are going to be things that work, but there will be many, many more things that don't work. So I think we should be cautiously hopeful and optimistic, but cautiously.
Oh, no, I appreciate that you say, that you don't know. And I just wanted to bring up one thing that was very interesting. You talk about, I know this from an autistic friend I have with somebody's kid, that autistic people, that maybe what they feel is that the world, they feel so much. It's not people assume they don't feel, but that they feel so much. It's so intense that it's uncomfortable for them. And I see this with this kid. He's one of the kids who walks on his tippy toes because he,
yep,
and he can't stand certain clothes because they scratch him too much. And I'm talking about like a soft sweatshirt. So
right.
That's something that's very interesting in a world we don't know too much about either.
Yeah, this is one of the things that was kind of surprising for me. I don't study autism directly, but given everything else I was writing about, I thought I should really get to know this literature better and see sort of what the latest neuroscience and psychology was telling us. And what I started to see was something very different than what the science was trying to say about 15 years ago. The story used to be sort of more focused on an insensitivity or indifference to the social world. Maybe these individuals just aren't that motivated, and that's why they aren't learning the right kinds of things when they're growing up to be socially skilled. And when I looked into the last 10 years of neuroscience, the story seemed to be almost the opposite, and I refer to this, it's not my term, but I refer to it as the intense world hypothesis, an idea that the social world, which is really complex and moving all the time around us, that was so intense for these individuals when they were little children, when they were a year old and 2 years old, that they did what lots of people do in the movie theater when the sound system comes on and it's too loud. They covered their ears and they turned away. And there's evidence that 1- and 2-year-old children, if you look back at home movies, they tend to turn away. And I think it has to do with the sensitivity, the oversensitivity they have to the social world. And so these individuals seem to be missing out on a lot of the training that the rest of us get in the toddler years to make us sort of the sophisticated social creatures that we are. And there's really nice data, I think, now to show that it's not insensitivity, it's oversensitivity to this that leads them to miss out on these cues that are so important to train our brains to be the social experts that we are.
Just to echo what you're saying about kids, I saw some research that John Gottman, the marriage and relationships researcher, presented at a conference, and he showed a video of a baby, and he talked about how parents, when the baby turns its head away, the parents would turn it back, but he said, no, you can't do that. The baby is calming itself. It needs to go away for a moment. You know, and,
right,
and we don't realize that, and that's one of these things where we're maybe not so good at theory of mind of the baby.
Right. Well, no, that's true. I the other thing, you asked before about whether or not we can sort of improve our social skills, and while I don't know yet for sort of adults whether that's true, I think for very young children who have autism or Asperger's, I think that the good news, if this story continues to sort of look to be true, is that you can teach these kids the normal things. You just need the environment to be a calmer social environment than the one that we naturally provide for our children. And so that's good news. It's not that they're uninterested in the social world, it's that it's too overwhelming. So we need to turn the volume down, and I think then we could sort of engage in some of the training that would be really helpful for these kids.
And I'm reminded of one of the great prescriptions you give later in the book, and I wish that this had been part of my school upbringing, and that's to train kids in social skills. It's so important, and I was an awkward kid. That's probably part of the reason I didn't have friends. And if people had taught me, my mother wasn't very good at it. Sorry, Mom, if you're listening. And how to manage these complex interactions, how to tell me that. And that seems something that would help a lot of kids not be bullied, get along better. And really, if you start young, they're going to do much better when they're 15 in the time that it's really painful.
Yeah, it's funny to me. I mean, we forget so much of what we learn in school because we're asked to learn things that don't seem so obviously interesting and important to us. But when you talk about our social lives, our emotional lives, this is sort of the perfect storm of stuff that children are absolutely riveted and interested in, and it's also incredibly important to our ability to get along and our success in life. So, nobody can argue that kids learning more about how to get along socially and connect and do well in social interactions, there's no question that that's going to help every aspect of your life, and we do almost none of that. Some schools do a little bit of it, but I actually think it should be something that's a more comprehensive part of education because it's so essential to our success as a species in every generation. We need to sort of do that well, and we spend zero time teaching it to our children.
Yeah, it's so important. And Carlin Flora, who is the former Psychology Today editor who wrote a book called Friendfluence, she talked about how parents can do this with their kids, how they can ask them, well, what would you do in this situation? What would you do in that to help them get to the point? Let them answer the questions and sort of prompt them. Don't tell them the answers. And just for parents, because they're not going to offer this in schools tomorrow. And I thought it was such a good idea you had. When we come back, I'm going to do a little station break, but we're going to talk about how broken hearts and broken legs are similar. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is social neuroscientist Dr. Matthew D. Lieberman, and his book is Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. So I love that broken hearts being like broken legs. Such a revelation to me reading your book. And you talk about this joke where the woman says, Doc, I've got a broken heart. What should I do? And he says, take 2 Tylenol a day and call me in a month. And it turns out from the research, your wife's research that you did with her colleagues, in fact, that this isn't so crazy. And your research, too. But she did some very specific research on this.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that sort of sets up this study that's kind of essential here is that my wife, Naomi Eisenberger, who's also a social neuroscientist, we do work together. And we did a study about a decade ago showing that when people were left out of a simple game while they were in an MRI scanner, their brains looked very much like they were experiencing physical pain. They showed lots of brain dynamics that were consistent with that. And so that was kind of a surprise at the time, and it leads to this notion that, well, if social pain, if social rejection really is to the brain like a kind of physical pain because it has such survival value, then if you take painkillers, Tylenol, for instance, then perhaps that affects social pain in similar ways to the ways that we all know it affects physical pain. And so my wife, Naomi Eisenberger, along with Nathan DeWall, another social psychologist, did a study where they did exactly that. They gave people Tylenol. One group took it every day for 3 weeks. Another group took a placebo. Neither group knew what they were taking. And every day they reported on the extent to which they were feeling feelings of social rejection. And lo and behold, over time, the people taking Tylenol reported less and less feelings of social rejection. And when they looked at their brains, they found that these folks who had been taking Tylenol showed less of that pain signature response when they were feeling social rejection in the scanner. So it's, I think, really surprising, really compelling evidence that the brain thinks that being socially connected is so important, just like having food is so important, just like not getting ourselves physically hurt is so important, that when any of these things go awry, our brain experiences that as a kind of pain, and social pain is a kind of pain, just like the others. It's just, it's different. Every kind of pain is different, but this is a real kind of pain.
I just wanted to emphasize, in case anyone wants to try that, one thing, acetaminophen, which is Tylenol,
yes,
that can be toxic to your liver. But I read this study. It's fascinating. I put it in my advice column. And if I remember correctly, they took 500 milligrams in the morning and 500 in the evening. And they did this by 21 days. It strongly showed this, but it even showed that before. And I think that's really incredible and is just great for people who are, you know, maybe suffering from a breakup or something and want to just make it go a little easier for 3 weeks, that you could actually take a pill. I mean, this is brave new world that we want.
I have to say, I don't recommend going and doing this on your own because, like you said, Tylenol is so toxic. And so if you take anything but the recommended doses, it you know, people die every year from Tylenol overdoses. So there are clinical trials actually going on right now. I'm not involved in them, but I know they're happening, to look at Tylenol as, you know, a treatment in a very controlled way. And depending on how those things go, there may be a recommended dosage at some point in the future for helping with social-related negative feelings. But I would leave it to the experts who know how to take it from the experimental lab to out into the world before people do too much self-experimenting, because it really
right.
is dangerous.
Right. Your caveat is good. The person, the epidemiologist who warned me about the toxicity to liver, also
yeah.
always says to me, all drugs have side effects. And so I
right.
think that's really important to remember. But it is pretty wonderful and great that they studied this. And so this, you actually, what was amazing in the studies that you've done is that you found that people, our brains treat social rejection like it's a painful event, whether or not the instance of social rejection matters or not. You did this study where people were told they were just playing against the computer, and the computer was preset to reject them, and they still experienced that social pain in their brain, which is so amazing.
Yeah, no, multiple studies, behavioral and neuroimaging studies, have found this effect that our brain really does seem to interpret, and psychologically we find it distressing and painful to be left out, even when we know it's just a computer doing it. There was one study that my colleague Kip Williams did where people were left out from a ball-tossing game when they had already said, I don't like these other people that I'm playing with. So even if you don't like them, if they leave you out unexpectedly, it is distressing and socially bothersome to be left out, which I think goes back to the playground, right? So when you're on the playground and you get picked last for any team, the people doing the picking, you may have disliked them before it ever started, but that doesn't change the fact that you don't want to be left out, even by them.
Yeah, and you point out, I love this, where you say, you're right that from a young age we're told, sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. But that's not true. And that bullied kids, they're far more likely to be depressed, like 7 times more. They're more likely to commit suicide. And we even wrote about a study in which IQ was substantially brought down by people who are contemplating social rejection.
Yeah. Roy Baumeister did this wonderful study where he actually did a very, very mild rejection of the individuals. He gave them a questionnaire, and based on the answers, and, you know, his response was fake, but based on the answers, he said, I'm going to tell you some stuff about what your future holds, you know, down the road, 30 years from now. These are 22-year-old kids. And he told some of them that their future held being socially alone, and that even if they have friends now, they're probably less likely to have friends, you know, in 20 years or something along those lines. And just being told this led their IQ on an IQ test to drop by about 15%, and even more dramatic, they then took a GRE test, the test you take to see if you can sort of get into the graduate school of your choice when you're trying to get a PhD. Those scores dropped in half after being socially rejected. If you take the idea of social pain being a kind of pain, this makes perfect sense. Who would take these tests right after, you know, breaking their arm? Because you'd say, well, look, I just broke my arm. I'm in intense pain. How could I possibly focus on doing well at some analytical test, focusing on my IQ? For social pain, we look at people around us who are in social pain, and I think there's some impulse to say, just get over it. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get over it. We would never say that about physical pain, but we do have some impulse to say that about social pain. And I think that, you know, when we learn that, no, the brain treats them both the same way, it makes a lot more sense in terms of, you know, why we should tell people to stop doing that.
I'm going to do a station break, but when I come back, I want to ask you if there's anything we can do to help people, like someone who is suffering from a breakup, knowing what you know from your research. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is social neuroscientist Dr. Matthew D. Lieberman, and his book is Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. So tell us. Okay, so you do all this research on social pain, and is there anything that you can think of? If someone's going through a breakup or their best friend has dumped them, is there some kind of social hug, Band-Aid that we can give them to help them at all, or is it pretty much hopeless?
Well, I mean, it's obviously not hopeless. Humans, over time, are remarkably resilient. People go through years of feeling socially disconnected and then become very socially connected again. And I think that, I think what's important is to recognize these things for what they are, which is, you know, biologically important needs that are being thwarted, that aren't sort of going the way we would want them to go, that we have to focus on those things and repair those wounds one way or the other, rather than acting as if those needs aren't there, acting as if there hasn't been some threat to our well-being. I don't think that works, but I think in our society, probably especially for men, there's an assumption that that's how we should treat these things, that we shouldn't get too caught up in social loss. And so I don't think there's any simple Band-Aid for fixing these things, but I think you have to recognize it before anything good is going to happen. And if you're a friend to one of these people, I think that sort of letting them know that their social bond with you is strong or important to you is one of the things that can help deal with that other social bond. It's not going to make the pain go away,
right?
But it probably can help act as a bridge until other sort of more natural processes kick in and help that person move forward.
Yeah, I think that's wise. I think people sometimes minimize how much just even a little show of faith can help someone. People think you have to write some kind of eloquent thing, but just even to write them a line and say, hey, I'm there for you, send them a postcard. You know, some people want to be alone in situations like that, but also, you know, this is an idea from the rest of your book about social engagement. Maybe you grab some friends and take them bowling or do something so they're in a group of people who care about them. They feel socially engaged, because you write over and over in these other chapters about how important it is and how good it feels to be socially connected. And in one of them, you even say that, you know, people are really, times are really tough and things are hard, that get together with people for coffee and do these sort of just normal little social events, and,
yep,
and they make us substantially happier.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think when I went through, you know, the biggest breakup of my life, someone who was, you know, not a close friend, someone who was friendly, invited me over to a dinner party that, you know, probably, you know, 9 times out of 10 she probably wouldn't have, but she did this time, and, you know, it's probably one of the only dinner parties I really remember, because at that particular moment, it made a huge difference for me, and it didn't make all the pain sort of go away forever, but it really had a meaningful impact on, okay, I'm still part of the social world, and I can connect with people. And it was a very, very positive moment that I think was part of the sort of step forward into getting back to a better place.
Now, you have a wonderful chapter on fairness in your book, Social, and you say that fairness is one of many cues that we have that we are socially connected, and your chapter title of that chapter is Fairness Tastes Like Chocolate. So explain.
Yeah. Originally, that was actually the title of the book, but my editor, I think, decided that that was too oblique, and they wanted something a bit more straightforward for the book's title, so it's a chapter title, Fairness Tastes Like Chocolate. And the idea there is that various social cues that let us know that we're liked, loved, respected by others, including being treated fairly, these are things that the brain interprets as social rewards, as little bits of social pleasure. So we have social pains that we've already been talking about, but the flip side, the reason why social pains hurt is because what we really want are the opposite. We don't want pain, we want pleasure, and there are various forms of social reward or social pleasure. And when we have those experiences, the brain's most basic reward system, the reward system we share with little, you know, mice and rats and so on, It lights up. It loves to be treated fairly. It loves to be told that somebody likes us or loves us or even just thinks we're a pretty good person. A complete stranger telling us that we seem like a pretty good person will light up this system in the brain much the same way as getting other things that we would expect to turn on the reward system, like chocolate, like money, like things that suggest that sex is around the corner, all these things that we would expect to turn on the brain's reward system for evolutionary reasons, those same brain regions respond to these social rewards as well.
I think you're talking about this study in Japan you wrote about. This is so fascinating, where participants in a scanner had strangers, total strangers they'd never meet, they didn't know, didn't care about. These strangers characterized them as sincere or dependable, and you say that these appraisals by people who are of no consequence reliably activated their reward systems, which is so amazing.
Yeah, no, it really is quite amazing. And, knowing that strangers are treating you in a positive way tells you something about sort of the social safety net that you're in your society. The amount of trust that exists in any society is a really big indicator of how well everything else goes in that society. And that's actually one of the things that worries me most right now, is that America seems to be in a period of declining trust, and I think that's very troubling, because I don't think we realize what an asset that has been for us over the last 200 years to be able to feel like we trust our neighbors, our communities, even our politicians, which we used to but don't anymore.
Yeah, this is the subject of my upcoming book, too, about the lack of community, how we've moved apart and how that's affected it. We're going to get into that, but I just wanted to underscore something you write about here that's so interesting. It's the evolutionary reason. You know, you say that their treatment, when people treat us fairly, it implies that they value us, and so it which suggests that when there are resources to be shared in the future, we're likely to get our fair share. So you can see why this would have mattered, you know, say 1.8 million years ago, very, very much, in a way that if we started evolving, well, that's sort of stupid, but if we, right now it matters a little less because we're not fighting over a single, you know, bison leg.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely correct, and I think that the sort of important lesson here that, you know, it's a little hard to sort of wrap your head around, but our brains are wired to be sensitive to this because evolutionarily, historically, it was very important, but the individual is not thinking in their heads, the reason I like being treated fairly is because it means that they're going to sort of share the large animal who's caught by the group, and they'll share some of that with me, even though I stayed behind to take care of the kids or something like that. That's not what we're thinking, but our brain is wired to feel that pleasure at being treated fairly because it played a role, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. And so now I don't think it's a selfish motivation to enjoy being treated fairly or to be sort of socially liked in some manner. It's just what we're wired to enjoy. And we're also wired to take pleasure in helping others. It's not just about being treated with respect.
Right. There's very, very interesting work on that. You bring out the various sides – whether it's selfish, whether it isn't. And to use that word selfish, it reminds me of something that was very interesting in your book, Social. And I'm talking with Dr. Matthew D. Lieberman. His book is Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. And this was the example of a grad student, Kelly Gildersleeve. And you said she spent a bunch of time streamlining some process for the department. When she was thanked for it, she pretended she was getting something out of it, which actually wasn't really true. So why do we pretend that we're, why do we say we're selfish when we haven't been?
Yeah, this is an idea that was written about by Dale Miller about 15 years ago. And it's this idea that we've been trained to believe that pretty much all behavior is selfish in one way or another. It's self-interested. So even when we see someone doing something that looks altruistic and looks like they're helping someone else, we sort of tend to think, well, what are they really after in the long run? So let's say someone's out on a first date. It's known that men on a first date are much better tippers than when they're not on first dates. And so you say, oh, well, the guy isn't really generous. He just wants to appear generous to the woman he's on a date with. And so this is really a selfish act, even though he's giving away his money. He's trying to curry favor and form a certain impression with the woman he's out with. And so we sort of tend to always look for what's that person's angle in what seems like positive behavior. And we've been told by great thinkers for centuries, altruism doesn't exist. It's all selfish if you sort of take a long enough view of what someone's trying to do. And so I think that, unfortunately, something that happens is when we engage in altruistic behavior, we're a little bit embarrassed to say the reason we did it is because we just sort of felt this altruistic motivation. We're afraid that people won't believe us or that we'll be sort of holding ourselves up as better than other people since we don't think other people are altruistic. And so we make up stories. It's called the exchange fiction. So I say, well, I did this because I was getting something back in return. And by making up that story, it gives me cover so that I don't look like I'm sort of being a goody-two-shoes. I look like I have a normal, understandable reason for why I did the things we did. The downside to this is that it just reinforces in everyone else that, oh, that person wasn't being altruistic. They were just being selfish because they told us how they were being selfish. And so it's a reinforcing negative spiral in a sense.
And part of this debate is about, oh, well, it feels good to be altruistic, so it's self-interested to be altruistic. But it really does, you point this out about community, as we were mentioning before, that community is such an important thing for making us happy, substantially happier, but yet our this social culture, our social structure has really declined. And I write about this, that we became really transient. We became able to move around. We have the internet. We have all these ways of being sort of quasi-connected. So we don't have to live a block away from our grandparents anymore, and most of us don't.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is obviously one of the big stories of the 20th century, and especially, you know, it's really been going on ever since cities started to become center points for living, but it's really accelerated in the last 30 years of people having much more mobility, going away to college and then going away further to pursue careers, and we do this because we've been taught that the way to be happy is to pursue your individual personal goals and to make as much money as you can along the way. And it turns out that this is, you know, not a terrible prescription. Everybody needs to make enough money to be able to pay the bills and be able to do some nice things and pay for hopefully their kids to go to college someday. But we have had a theory of the well-being that comes from money that is really, really off from the reality of what money does for us. And usually in the pursuit of those things that's going to make us more money, we end up making choices that keep us away from family and friends, either by moving across the country or just by staying at the office later and going on more work travel trips to try to get ahead. These choices that we make take us away from some of the real sources of happiness that actually don't cost very much money.
And just to get in a little deeper on the wealth, this is something economist Robert Frank talks about, relative wealth, and you write about this, that what matters, you know, that is, are you making as much money as your neighbors? And Frank, at a conference I went to, he gave an example that if you were in some kind of island country and somebody else had a lean-to, but you had a grass hut, you'd be, you know, really on top of the world. Whereas if you're in Beverly Hills and you had a grass hut, you know, next to those big houses, you'd feel like crap.
That's true. Although if you had a lean-to in Beverly Hills, you could probably still sell it for $1 million. So
right, a good point.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And you talk about that you know that also in addition to the relative wealth, you know, to earn it, we need to spend so much of our time, you know, at the office and everything. And you talk about, for example, here we both live in Los Angeles, LA traffic. I mean, my friends in the Valley, I live by the beach. I mean, if you have a party at 3 a.m, I'll come. But otherwise, the roads are going to be hellish, and I'll need some kind of pill when I get there.
Yeah, no, there's no question. I have lost friends living in Los Angeles because they live 5 miles away. And, you know, they're in a slightly different phase of life, let's say. They're not, you know, they don't have kids yet. We do. And they live just far enough that, you know, we're not going to Friday night try to fight that traffic. It's just that bad. But, you know, I think the sort of more common story is moving 1,000 miles from your parents or your grandparents. And it creates all sorts of havoc that we think is worth it because we think the career success will be more valuable to our well-being than the other things that we're giving up.
And now you talk about ways to rebuild community. I'm not big on tax breaks because I'm a libertarian, or taxes in general, but this is a way that would probably be more effective than just suggesting it to people. You suggest giving a tax break that would make apartment buildings have social spaces. So like in dorms where there is some kind of group area where you watch TV. So that seems like, you know, that would bring some people together.
Yeah, I mean, what I talked about in the book is just how different the floor of a college dormitory is from something that visually is very, very similar, the typical floor of a large apartment building, and one is an incredibly social space and the other usually seems, and I've lived in both, when you live in an apartment building where there's, you know, 30 apartments on the floor, nobody talks to anybody in the apartment building. Even though many of you are going through very similar stages of life, there's probably several people who have small children or are in their first real job, but there aren't the easy ways to connect that colleges build into the dormitory experience. And I'm not into, you know, raising taxes particularly myself, but I think there's sort of this general idea that, you know, people who build apartment buildings, their incentive is to get as many dollars as they can per square foot by putting in as many separate apartment units without much thought for how you build a social space that will create more well-being in general. And, you know, if we shifted towards that kind of building and that kind of structure, there might be real value to the people living in those apartment buildings. A third of Americans live in apartment buildings, and they're really not very conducive to, I think, social well-being the way they're set up.
Well, I live in a rental house, and this is a thing in Southern California. Landlords will build two houses on one property. And so I sort of experience this with my neighbors because we're within a gate. And so today I, you know, their Visa bill, and I ran back and said hello, and she's diapering the baby, and their door's open. And they can just, I mean, it's not like you're knocking on some impenetrable fortress door. You know, it's just, hi, you know, and they do the laundry in the back of my house. And it's a very nice feeling, and I realized from reading your book what nice little community that I have just on this little place, and there are different people, they're architects, they have 3 young kids, and they and I have talked about something, it's called co-housing, and this is where people intentionally move into communities of like 5 houses or 12 houses or an apartment building, and you're there with like old people and kids, so you have the old community we used to have when you lived in a small town.
Right, yeah, no, it's that, or, you know, what you'll see in Israel in a kibbutz, where you really have this sense of more communal living and some shared spaces. I have relatives in Northern California who live in a housing community where there's essentially a dining hall in the middle of a bunch of houses, and that's where most of the people living there eat their, you know, at least their dinners every day, and so they are together in a way that we do in college, but most of us don't ever do again after college.
Oh, and I don't want to forget to mention this. There's something you talk about, you know, that if you are challenged sort of to make time and ends and everything else meet, that there's something called social snacking, where just thinking or writing about people you care about can provide some of the same benefits as face-to-face social relationships. That's amazing.
Yeah, and, you know, various researchers have seen this. My wife and I have done some of the research on this, where just seeing a photograph of someone you love can reduce the sort of pain of social loss in a very sort of literal sense when you look at what's going on in the brain. And there's other work just suggesting that writing about sort of different people that are important to you, these things aren't full substitutes, but they're part substitutes. They are a snack, not a full meal of our social connection. Yeah,
but that helps.
Much.
And that, another really interesting thing I want to bring out, because everybody says, oh, the Internet, it's terrible. So it used to be terrible. You say 1998, Robert Kraut examined, you know, the state of things on the Internet. And, yes, people were in their own individual chat rooms. But then in 2004, Facebook, and things changed. And so now the Internet is actually leading to people feeling better, being more social. I know that it is for me. They're people I know better because I follow them on Facebook.
Yeah, no, I think that it has changed the way we use the Internet. And, you know, the fascinating thing about Facebook is that the vast majority of the connections on Facebook are between people who do have some connection outside of Facebook. So it tends to be a way of reinforcing people we really know, as opposed to just being a purely digital thing where we go into a chat room and talk to other people who are interested in the same baseball cards we are, or something like that. And so it really has changed that. So, you know, parents and grandparents and different folks can see, you know, somebody's birthday party or see some event that they otherwise might have no connection to. And again, I don't want to suggest that that's a replacement for people physically getting together. It's not. But when you compare it to not having any of that, I think it's a huge positive, and the data is more consistent with that now, that now it seems to be a positive for people's mental well-being to be more connected through Facebook and so on, whereas back in the 90s, it seemed to have more negative effects on people's well-being to be on the Internet more.
Right. Now, we only have about 4 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you very interesting stuff in your book, Social, and I am talking with Dr. Matthew D. Lieberman. His book is Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. Very interesting stuff. I didn't finish my thought on business, on being social, on the social culture and business. And very interestingly, you say that business organizations don't choose their leaders for the qualities that would make them good leaders of a social group, but that's really important.
Yeah, so there's this really nice work that shows that if you look at the qualities that people will say are present in someone who they see as a great leader, we tend to assume it'll be all about their sort of analytical skills and their sort of motivation to get things done. But it turns out that that's only moderately linked to someone being perceived as a great leader. When they have those skills combined with strong social skills, the ability to get along with others and to diagnose what's going on socially on the teams that they lead and so on, these folks are much more likely to be seen as great leaders. So sort of analytical ability plus social skills seems to be one of the best recipes for being a great leader. And the thing is that because we don't recognize that this is the recipe, it seems that we don't hire for this combination very often. And a research survey that came out based on, I think, 6,000 leaders that were being assessed found that across all these leaders, their employees, the people who work for them, said that only about 1% of all of those leaders actually were strong in both the sort of analytical focus and the social focus, that it tends to be something that you get one or the other of, but not both. And so that seems to be something that may be lacking in the leaders that we're hiring, and something that we don't really focus on training once they are hired.
And you say that status and connection and fairness, these are all things that can trigger social pain in the brain, that these are things they should pay more attention to, you know, that people really care about their status. And in fact, you wrote about how they gave up money for status to get a gold star in the President's Club. And that this is, you know, that these leaders in business are really emphasizing the wrong things, that money matters, but that people care. You write about where they, if they're given an opportunity to help, their coworkers, they feel much more connected if they're told they can donate money, for example, to coworkers who are having a hard time. They actually seem to be better employees after that.
Yeah, there's a number of studies that are coming out. A number of them are coming from the lab of Adam Grant, who wrote one of my favorite books of the year, Give and Take. He's a business school professor at UPenn, and he's found in a number of studies that when people are given the ability to engage at work in helping others, or even are just reminded about the way in which the work they already do helps others, their productivity goes up. So it's not just that they sort of feel good for a couple of minutes that they got to help someone. He's assessed folks who have been reminded about how their work helps other people, and a month later, their productivity is still twice what it was before he did the study. It's a yes. really amazing finding, but one that makes a lot of sense once you recognize how important it is for us to be socially connected, and helping others is one of the ways that we can be more socially connected.
Absolutely. And actually, Adam Grant was on 2 weeks ago, so people can go back a couple of weeks and listen to my wonderful show with him on his book, Give and Take. I love that book. I was as inspired as I am by yours, Social. We're out of time, but I just wanted to ask you if you have any final words to leave people with about being social and what we can do, what it means, what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the main thing is that we need to recognize the role these kinds of social factors play in our lives and also in the lives of other people around us. There's that meme that goes around on the internet about how everyone you meet is fighting a struggle that you know nothing about. And I think oftentimes that struggle is something social, and oftentimes we don't share or let on that that's going on. If we have a broken leg, we're happy to tell people about it. We let them sign the cast and all those sorts of things. When it comes to our social pains, we sort of keep that to ourselves. We think that's not really sort of fit for public consumption, but it's something that almost everyone goes through, and I think it's something that, you know, people shouldn't be ashamed of, and it's important to try to move forward recognizing the value of these things, because it affects our ability to, you know, be smarter, happier, and more productive, and those are all good things that we should strive for.
Wow, I think that's great. This is Advice Goddess Radio. Amy Alcon. I've been talking with Dr. Matthew D. Lieberman. His book is Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. Thank you so much. This was a great show.
Enjoyed it.